I've been passing out a handout for today. If you did not get one, please raise your hand. We'll get someone to get you one of those. All right, let me tell you about the class today here at the beginning. We're supposed to cover all of 1 Corinthians chapter 11. But I will tell you right now that we're going to completely ignore the latter half of this chapter. Reason for that is, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion among brethren through the years about the first half. In actuality, we cover the latter half quite a bit. The latter half of this, at least certain verses of it, we read quite often before we partake the Lord's Supper. So we give the latter half quite a bit of attention in a variety of ways. We probably haven't given nearly enough attention to the first half. And so that's the plan for today. I've given you a study guide for 1 Corinthians 11, 2 through 16. We're going to go through all this in just a minute because I think some of these need a little bit more explanation if they're going to be helpful to you. But let me explain the reasons why I decided on this particular approach. I had several options. I could have taken the time to defend my position as regards all of this here in this chapter. And in order to do that very thoroughly, I would have had to have spent the entire 45 minutes. And it's likely that somebody would think, well, that's not exactly fair. You didn't even give anybody time to offer any kind of counter arguments. And you would be right. I don't think that would be very fair. But then also, I could have just opened it up for discussion. We could have read 1 Corinthians 11, 2 through 16. I said, okay. Any thoughts? Is this still binding today? What are the applications we need to make today? And I suspect we would have got stuck on maybe two or three different points, and all of a sudden the 45 minutes would be up, and we wouldn't have really thoroughly discussed the passage. So I just decided that perhaps, at least now, the best thing to do was to offer something that would be helpful to you for your own study. Help you to wrestle with some of these issues. Now, in this handout, there's going to be a number of questions that are designed to direct you to a deeper study of this passage, okay, on your own. Now, this is very imperfect. You're going to read through this and you're going to think, well, he probably should have asked this, or he should have included this question or that question. And again, I would have no argument with you about that. But what I'm hoping is the questions that are asked will kind of get your mind rolling. And as you ask those questions and as those prompt deeper study, more questions will come to your mind and you'll study it even deeper than that. I have no control over what all of you do with this after this class and when you go home. But here's what I do know. The meek and humble among us will take it, and they will study diligently. Okay. And I want to go out on a limb and say that the meek and humble make up the overwhelming majority of the group right here. And so I do hope you'll take it home, and I do hope you'll study it very diligently. And again, that's the sort of disposition that we all need to have in the eyes of God. Again, it's probably for me to be able to explain these questions. It's probably going to take the entire 45 minutes. So there's not going to really be any time for discussion. Again, the whole thing, the whole design of this is to get you to take it home and study more diligently. All right, I felt like I needed to go ahead here at the beginning and just briefly go over the four main views of this passage in And please understand that each one of these positions may be argued somewhat differently. In other words, there are variants to each one of these positions. Number one, there is only one covering discussed in this passage, and it is the hair. Number two, some type of artificial covering is involved, but the passage deals only with those exercising spiritual gifts. They're in the first century, and therefore has very limited application to us today. Number three, the artificial covering described in this passage was part of first century custom or culture, and so the point of the text is that God did not want women doing something shameful during that time. In other words, it was dependent on the culture of that day. And then number four, of course, is the divine ordinances found in this passage applied then, and they still apply today. Now, those are very, very brief explanations of each one of those. All right, so let's just work our way through this handout. And again, I want to offer just a few little additions that maybe will clear up any misunderstanding that my poor wording may have caused. It's a difficult text, which should keep us from being divisive over it. But should the difficulty of it keep us from studying diligently? And I hope the answer that you have, I hope it's the same as mine, is no. Don't let it keep you from studying it diligently. Decisions must be made about the applications in this text. Whatever decisions we make must be resolved with a clear conscience. And that's extremely important. Now, I want to address that divisive thing for just a minute. And maybe illustrate it with another issue. Let's say that we, at some point, had two, three, four, five people who just were insistent on the fact that we needed to have instruments of music in our worship. I'm not going to let that go without contending with those people. That is, if they're being insistent on it. And a couple of reasons why I'm not going to let that particular issue go, why I'm going to stand more firmly is, first of all, that one is exceedingly more clear, okay, than this one right here. Okay? It's not hard to determine that there is no authority for instruments of music in our worship. The second reason would be, if that was imposed upon us, if we had instruments of music, what's that? Who all is that going to necessarily involve? Every single person here, right? So we would all be involved in sin. And so the difference, of course, is this one is not quite as clear. There are some difficulties in the text, as we've already noticed. And then secondly, if you decide, women particularly right now, if you decide to wear a covering, what others do is not going to affect you. You can go right on wearing it, okay? And so just a couple of differences to note as to why we don't need to be divisive over it. We haven't been in the almost 38 years I've been here, and we don't intend to be moving forward. Okay, so let's make that clear at the beginning. All right, so getting back, or this is kind of there's several sort of follow-ups to that first part there. Ladies, suppose someone asks you why you cover your head or why you do not. How would you answer? Likewise, men, what reasons would you give for your position on the text? I think we can think of some bad answers, right? Some bad answers would be, I really have no idea. Now, if you're a new Christian and you're just being exposed to this passage, perfectly understandable, okay? Just haven't had time to even really wrestle with it and study with it, perfectly understandable. But for those who have been Christians for a long time, you need to have some reason why you're doing or not doing the things that you are. Another bad answer would be, well, that's just the position that my family has always taken. Okay, well, they could be right, they could be wrong, but you have to decide on your own, right? You can't just follow what the family has done. Another bad answer would be, well, let's say in regard to women in particular, just given this particular example, maybe women who do not choose to wear a covering. Well, most people do not. And that many people can't be wrong. Again, not an answer. What if the What if the majority position was the other? What if most women did wear a coat? Would we just side with the majority then? We can't make decisions based upon that. And so we're left with just wrestling with the text as the very best we can. All right, so the third one there. Should we decide to dismiss these applications as irrelevant to us today? That is, I understand that there are portions of the passage that you would still consider very much relevant. The order of authority and things said about creation. But as far as the applications, if you should decide to dismiss these as not binding, do we have reasons for doing so that we are prepared to take before the Lord? Again, a very important question to ask. In other words, just how confident are you with the reasons you have for what you do? Okay? Just how confident are you? Is there that clear conscience that we talked about earlier? All right, so whatever view we take, another question to consider, has it been steered more by assumptions gleaned from other sources or from the text itself? For example, and I don't know, you know, if anybody takes this position or starts from this point, but this is just an example. There are a number of commentators. If you go to some of the commentaries on this passage, there are a number of those commentators who will say, okay, the uncovered head in Corinth indicated that someone was a prostitute. And so the point of the passage is that he didn't want these women doing something that would indicate that they were kind of in that line of work. In other words, that would be the shameful part of it, that you're presenting yourself as the prostitutes would. Well, it may be true that the uncovered head indicated a prostitute in the city of Corinth. But do we understand everything in the text in that light? One thing we know for sure is that Paul never in this passage used that as a reason for doing so. I mean, I know he indicates the shame, but there's nothing specifically said about it. So we've got to be careful that we don't go to some outside source and hear something that said, this is, I believe, what the situation was. We start from that point, it's going to be awful easy to read some things into the text if we're not careful. I want to say something else about outside sources. We kind of like to quote outside sources that would sort of go along with our position or whatever. And I haven't done nearly as much reading as I ought to, but I have done enough to know that those outside sources are not exactly in full agreement as to exactly what this indicated, what covered, uncovered, exactly what the customs and so forth were of the different people. They're not exactly in full agreement. And so just know going in that that's going to be the case. All right, the word traditions there in verse 2. Right there at the beginning of the passage, sometimes this has caused quite a bit of discussion in and of itself. That's the word, of course, that's used in most translations. There are some variations to that. But the traditions he mentions there, are they divine or human? Just as I delivered them to you. That's found in the latter part of this same verse. Do 1 Corinthians 11:23 and 15:3 help indicate the source of these traditions? Look down in chapter 11 and verse 23. For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you. It goes on to talk about, of course, the institution of the Lord's Supper. Now, I realize that the first part of our chapter 11, verse 2, does not have the received from the Lord part. But you do have similar terminology there in terms of delivered. Over in chapter 15 and verse 3. In chapter 15 and verse 3, very similar expression. Paul says, for I delivered to you first of all that which I also received. Presumably from the Lord. And we know that because he goes on to talk about Christ being Christ dying, being buried, and being raised again. So when he says, just as I delivered them to you, is it implied that that's the same as these other passages? That which I received from the Lord, I delivered to you. Please understand, the word traditions means that which is passed down or handed down. And it can be passed down from one of two sources, right? It either comes from God or it comes from man, which is the case here. Again, does that terminology help us decide? That which I deliver to you. How is the same word used in 2 Thessalonians 2:15? And also in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 6. In chapter 2 and verse 15 of 2 Thessalonians, Paul says, stand fast and hold the traditions. Clearly in that context, he's using it in terms of that which comes from God. Chapter 3 and verse 6. Withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. Well, you're not fixing to withdraw from a brother for violating some tradition of man, right? So clearly it's used there. So again, what is the evidence? Where does the evidence point us in terms of the meaning of the word traditions there? Okay, following up from that. But I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ. The head of woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. There in verse 3. Does this line or order of authority indicate a general headship of men over women or just husbands and wives? And that has been a much debated point as well. And really it's sort of critical to the understanding of certain applications in this text. So, what I'm suggesting is, read all of verses 2 through 16 and determine which is better supported by the text itself and by passages elsewhere. In other words, can we find passages elsewhere that would serve as a good commentary on the meaning of this? Now, I mean, I've heard it said before, somebody said, well, Brian, it's pretty clear you're not the head over, you know, someone else's wife, the same way that you're the head over yours. I get that. Okay, so let's grant that. I'm not the head over Carolyn Brown. Okay, Dave is. We understand that. But is that enough? I'm just asking, okay? Is that enough to completely answer the question? I believe you're probably going to find phrases in this whole discussion in this section that would seem to uniquely apply to the husband-wife relationship. But again, does that fully answer the question? Is there a general order of authority? In other words, is the general principle here of men over women or just husbands over wives? Wrestle with the text. Study it diligently. Look at passages elsewhere. And see where that takes you. Alright, so let's kind of get to the heart of it here with the next one. Let's read verses 4. And the first part of verse 5. This is where we get into some applications, of course. Every man praying or prophesying, having his head covered, dishonors his head. But every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered, dishonors her head. Clearly, these are the two main applications Paul makes in the text. All right, here's how this section breaks down. You know, when I say section, I'm talking about all of verses 2 through 16. Here's what you need to be sure to do, and here are the reasons you need to do it. Okay. Whatever position you may take, and I know there's some thorny questions in all of this, okay, but let's all grant that. But the structure of the passage is pretty clear. Okay. As far as the way to kind of outline it, here's the expectation, here's what you need to be doing. And then now let me tell you some reasons why you need to do it. So, as you kind of, maybe that may even be a good starting point, just kind of go through and say, all right, here's what he tells me to do. And now I'm going to just kind of list the things that Paul says in this text as to the reasons why that ought to be done. Pay attention not just to the reasons given, but I think it's also important to pay attention to the reasons that are not given. Those may be compelling as well. So take a hard look at that. Okay. I lost my place here for just a minute. Yeah, okay, we'll move on to the next one. All right, one of the reasons given in the text is because of the angels there in verse 10. Listen, if you know for certain exactly what that phrase means, then let's be sure and talk afterwards. It's really difficult to know with any sort of certainty. Do consider at least a few passages as to what may be involved there. First of all, we know that angels are witnesses to what we do. They have an intense interest in what we're doing. Okay? And that's indicated by a couple of passages at least you could add to this. But Luke 15:10, also 1 Corinthians 4 and verse 9. And then there's also a very interesting passage in Jude 1 and verse 6, which talks about angels who did not keep their proper domain. Okay? Who did not keep their proper domain and who have been punished appropriately. Now, would that kind of seem to fit the context here? Yeah, I guess an argument could be made. Right. But again, it's hard to be completely certain about that. We do know, of course, that that's one of the reasons offered. All right, so let's get into this praying or prophesying business. Again, another area which has provoked a considerable amount of discussion. Praying or prophesying, the times indicated when men should not cover their heads and when women should. Is it at least possible these two activities could be representative of other activities as well? Now, the question has been asked many times by Bible students, well, why did he single out these two things? You know, it's hard to say. But could it be represented? And the reason I say that, you do have some examples of that elsewhere, as in Isaiah 56 and verse 7. The temple is called a house of prayer. Is that all it was? A lot of things that went on in the temple, right? And yet it's reduced here to a house of prayer. Okay. So prayer obviously would stand for much more than just that one specific activity. Or what about in 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 8, which we will study next week, Lord willing, where it speaks of spiritual gifts vanishing away, and yet only three are mentioned. Tongues, prophecies, and knowledge. It talks about these three things will pass away. Well, he's not just talking about those three things pass away. Those would be representative of the entirety of spiritual gifts. And so does praying or prophesying indicate perhaps more than that? Again, it's a little bit difficult to say for sure. One of the things we know for sure is that praying or prophesying will be talked about in some detail in chapter 14 in the context of the assembly. And, of course, we'll be studying that in the next couple of weeks. All right, so, again, a follow-up to that. Do these regulations apply to whenever and wherever praying or prophesying is done, including the assembly, or the assembly exclusively? I understand. Another difficult question that arises in this text. I would think the assembly would at least have to be included, since, as we just said a few moments ago, praying and prophesying are discussed in chapter 14 in some detail in the context of the assembly. So, the question is, are there indications in the full text to help answer the question? That's one of the things that we need to be really focused on as we go through. What are the indications here? Where exactly do these regulations apply? Looking at verse 16, this is just one thing to consider. How is church or churches used throughout the rest of 1 Corinthians? Well, you see the passages given there on the handout. And it seemed to me that in each one of those were church or churches used in terms of the assembly or the assemblies when they were gathered together for worship. Is that a clue? Is that point us in a certain direction? I'm not saying stop there by any means, okay? But I'm just trying to say let's look at all the evidence. If, according to some, women were exercising spiritual gifts in the assembly, how does this square or how does this harmonize with chapter 14, verses 34 and 35, where the women are told to keep silent? Just this past week, I read the position of one man, and his position was basically this. Clearly, in the first century, there were women who had spiritual gifts. No argument there. Okay, that's clearly indicated in text. And so the teaching of the passage is that it seems that some of these women were forgetting to put on their covering, which would indicate a subjection to the men who were present. In other words, they could exercise the spiritual gifts in the assembly as long as they had this, as the passage says, this sign of authority on their head. Okay. This particular brother took that position. So is there a way to reconcile that particular view with what is stated over there in chapter 14, verses 34 and 35. So, I'm not sure how helpful this is, at least for right now. There's no way we can digest all of this, you know, right now, okay? But I'm just trying to give you some things, put some things in your hand that will sort of help, prompt a number of different questions. All right, concerning praying or prophesying. And looking ahead to chapters 12 through 14 and its discussion of spiritual gifts, prophesying is clearly labeled a spiritual gift. Several passages you see there, both in chapters 12 and 13. But what about praying? Sometimes people point to 1 Corinthians 14, that section there, verses 14 through 17, which speaks of praying in a tongue. Must have been a spiritual gift too. Well, it's never labeled that. And the question I would ask is, in that particular section, how is both praying and singing used in that context? Read the text carefully. Are they not both used to illustrate what is taught previously? That tongue speaking is pointless without an interpreter. In other words, the main point in that section is, this tongue speaking is of no value unless you have an interpreter. It seems to me, at least, that what he's getting at there is he uses, praying and singing as kind of an example. If you don't pray in words that people can understand, if you don't sing in words that either you or anybody else can understand, what profit is it? And so those seem to be used more as examples or illustrations. Okay. Praying or prophesying in regard to the men. Used in verse 4, time when, of course, their head should not be covered. Praise or prophesies in verse 5 in regard to the women, talking about how they should have their head covered during these times. And by the way, I believe there is some significance, at least. I'll let you study this out as to how much, but it's not praying and prophesying. There's a difference between and or. So I think that's significant as well. In regard to prayer specifically, would these regulations apply only to the leader or to all who join together with him in prayer? In other words, would the man who's leading the prayer need to make sure that his head was uncovered? And yet it would be okay if everybody praying along with him had their head covered? Does it apply just to the leader, or does it apply to all who were participating? Does 14:16 help answer that question? That talks about, someone being able to say amen at your giving of thanks. Well, when we say amen, basically what we're saying is it is true. It is true. And so what does that imply? If somebody else is saying amen, or it is true, that means they've been what? Praying right along with you. Okay. And concerning prophecy, would others be participating at least in some manner while one prophesied? Chapter 14, verse 29 says, let two or three prophets speak and let the others judge. The American Standard Version says, let the others discern. The ESV says, weigh what is said. The New American Standard, it says, weigh carefully what is said. And so, 14:29, does this help answer all the questions? I don't know. Okay. But I'm just trying to get us to understand that there's a participation of all, and that's clearly indicated here. In other words, the others, while these two or three prophets speak in turn, they're not just sitting there doing nothing. Okay. They're engaged in it, right? And they're weighing carefully what all is being said. And a lot of these questions, I'm raising these because, you know, that view that of the spiritual gifts, you know, it applies mainly to those exercising these gifts, has very limited. That's a very popular view, and I'm just asking us to think through a lot of the different issues related to all of that. Okay, judge among yourselves, verse 13. Again, quite a bit has been said about this. So what does he mean there? Judge among yourselves. Does this just simply mean make up your own mind in terms of what's best for this situation? What's best in this particular culture in which you live? Is that what he's saying? Or does 1 Corinthians 10:15 help us better understand the purpose of this statement? If you look over in chapter 10, and verse 15, we covered this last week as Andrew taught the class. Just notice how this passage is structured for your consideration. I speak as to wise men, judge for yourselves what I say. Well, what does he go on to do? Now, his main concern is he just got through saying, flee from idolatry. And he's going to make an application about, you know, going into an idol's temple and how when you do that, you're having fellowship with the demons. But what does he do before he gets to that fellowship with demons? He offers some examples or some illustrations, right? What are the illustrations? The Lord's Supper. And these priests were taking of the altar. Okay. So when he says, judge for yourselves and so forth, he goes on to give some illustration. Now, is that kind of the way it's designed there, beginning in verse 13? Is it proper, judge among yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, is a dishonor to him? See how he, you know, uses an illustration to reinforce or to back up, you know, the main point that he's trying to make. And again, I think there's a very similar structure to that passage there in chapter 10. All right, so looking at the rest of verse 13, is it proper, some translations say seemly, other translations say comely, for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Again, a lot of debate about the word proper here. I read a brother just this past week. I'd seen this quote before, but he said the term proper finds its meaning in the customs and cultures of that day. Could it possibly be used in that sense here? Possibly. But that's a bold statement when you look at how the word is used elsewhere. The word proper is from the Greek word prepo, and it's found elsewhere in Matthew 3:15. Well, you see the passage. We don't have to go through all of that. And every one of those is talking about something which is proper or fitting in the eyes of God. And so I'm certainly not going to go off on a limb and just make a, you know, a statement like that. That's what this word means. It has to do with the customs and cultures of that day. Not in all of these other passages. Okay. So do these other verses help explain its usage here? Or does it mean something entirely different in this particular context? Again, I'm urging us all to study that carefully. Does not even nature itself teach you in verse 14? The word nature here, at least to some, means the norms of the society in which we live. Kind of going back to that whole custom argument. Well, is that true? And all I can say is study the uses elsewhere, including this particular context. Why does he even bring up nature in the first place? And kind of what is he getting at with all of that? All right, from verses 14 to 15. Long hair on a woman. We'll get to some other applications we've got to wrestle with, right? That covering issue, we got to wrestle with that. But we also got to wrestle with this hair issue, right? Long hair on a woman, is it still a glory to her? long hair on a man, is it still a shame or dishonor to him? So it comes down to this question, right? This clear distinction in appearance, which is brought out in this passage, is it dependent on the customs of our time and the region in which we live, or is it universally applicable? I decide, right? And say, men, if you decide to wear your hair down to your shoulders, do that in good conscience. Okay. You've got some rock solid reasons for doing that that you're prepared to take before the Lord in judgment. In other words, if somebody says, I notice you're wearing your hair really long, what's that all about? Well, let me explain to you. Would you be able to explain? I don't know. Again, it's something that's very important. Verse 15, her hair is given to her for a covering. Verse 15. But is that the only covering discussed in this passage? As I pointed out at the very beginning of the class, there are some who take that position. Now, one question that I would ask in regard to that is, and I know there's more that needs to be said about this, more questions that need to be posed, but how do you have a covering or not? That is, when praying or prophesying, if it's hair. Your hair is just there. Okay. So, I have a lot of questions, but one thing that seems pretty clear to me is there's one type of covering discussed in the early part of the passage. And then the covering of the hair is used as an example or an illustration as a supporting argument for what's been taught previously. All right, then you have verse 16. Seems like I've been saying this a lot, but a much debated verse. The use of the word custom. You know, I guess sometimes, you know, it's easy to read through this passage and you're trying to decide, okay, what's the application today? And you see that word custom, bingo, that's it. That's it. But the usage of that word, does that for sure remove it from the realm of command? And I would urge you to consult a variety of translations. Okay, I think the New American Standard says, if any man seems to be contentious, let him know that there is no other practice. There is no other practice. Okay, so consult a variety of translations. If you're kind of troubled by, okay, you know, what's the wording here? What does all this mean? You know, get you about five or six reliable translations out there. Kind of see if that will help some. I will point this out from Hebrews 10 and verse 25, a passage that some of us at least would be familiar with. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some. That's how it reads in the New King James. In other translations, it is as the habit of some. Other translations even say as the custom of some. It's the same word that's used here in 1 Corinthians 11:16, with this minor exception. In chapter 11, verse 16, the prefix son is in front of it. And the prefix son just means together or in union. Okay? In union. And so it's really basically the same word that's used in those two places. I don't think anybody is going to argue that Hebrews 10:25 is just talking about some custom that's of that particular day. Some other questions to ask about it. How exactly would one be contentious based on the context? When he says, if any man seems to be contentious, how would that happen? Again, based on what's been said before. Is Paul teaching that this is the practice of all the churches? Or is he saying that no other church does it? In other words, no other church does what you're doing. Is that what he's saying? Or does he say that if it becomes a matter of contention, then don't make an issue out of any of this? I've heard all three of those questions. I mean, I've heard all three positions taken on what 1 Corinthians 11, verse 16 says. Now, one thing we can say for sure, it doesn't mean all that. Okay? It doesn't mean all of that. So, again, another verse for us to really dig into and talk about. So, let me repeat this, lest anybody forget what I said at the beginning. These questions are very much imperfect. I think they're helpful. Probably didn't go far enough, okay? But again, I'm hoping that, okay, as I go through this study guide and I wrestle with these particular questions, I hope even more questions will arise. I know some of you may even be thinking now, well, I wish he would have asked this question that would have directed us to this other issue as well. And I get that. Okay, I completely understand. But I knew I would have 45 minutes, and I was trying to be as concise as possible. And I'll say one other thing. In regard to the spiritual gifts, I meant to say this earlier. We got to be careful that whatever position we take on this, and if it's the spiritual gifts argument in particular, and maybe those who take this view are still able to harmonize that with what I'm about to say. But we're going to be studying that whole thing extensively in the next few weeks, chapters 12 through 14. Whatever we do, let's don't take a position that chapters 12 through 14 and what was going on in the first century with their prophesying and with the miracle working and the tongue speaking and so forth, that none of that has any application to us today. You know, there are principles all throughout these next three chapters that will be filled with application, even for us today, right? So we've got to be careful that we don't head too far in that direction. Okay. Everybody ready to go study? As I said, the meek and humble will study. They will wrestle. They will try to come with some decisions, some applications that in the end they will be able to have a clear conscience concerning. All right, thank you very much.